We'd like to take a moment to talk about Jane, one of our sponsors who helped make this episode possible. Jane is a practice management software built for every kind of mental health practitioner and is thoughtfully designed with your clients in mind. Jane makes it convenient to meet with individuals, couples, or families, whether that's online, via Jane's telehealth options, or in person.
From day one, you can expect unlimited customer support through onboarding that sets you up for success and a 99.99% software reliability that ensures that Jane is always ready to start the day with you.
Just as you are always learning and improving, Jane is too. The team at Jane values customer feedback and uses it to design even more helpful features. So you can think of Jane as a software that grows with you.
If you're curious to see Jane in action, head to jane.app/mentalhealth/US to book a free one-on-one demo. You can also mention the code DCPOD at sign up for a 2-month free grace period on your new Jane account.
I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Divergent Conversations. We're continuing on with our collection on worn down and worthy, hashtag not your typical wellness. And today is a fun episode because we asked the audience, especially in our Substack groups, about wellness tips that you've been given that typically don't work. And we want to talk about not just kind of pick them apart a bit in a fun way, but also offer some adaptation because we don't want to just completely shit talk a bunch of wellness tips because that just doesn't feel useful despite that being my immediate instinct.
We can't deconstruct without reconstructing or offering reconstruction. And you know how I learned this was growing up evangelical because I was like running around deconstructing everything like, well, that theology is shit because this da 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 da. And then from feedback from people was like, you know, it's a lot more hopeful to cast a vision of what you're moving toward, not just what you're tearing down. And that's always stuck with me of it is really easy just to tear stuff down.
Yeah.
But that's not very agency giving or hope filled. So that like, yeah, can we have fun with some deconstruction of wellness that's perhaps not been easy for us or perhaps caused shame? And can we like build up a thing too?
Yes, exactly. I agree. And I'm going to shift more into that mode. Tearing stuff down feels good in the moment, but it never lasts very long. It's a very like quick dopamine hit. And then it's kind of like, and now what? So yeah, we are going to offer adaptation and just perspective on some of the stuff that you gave us. And we appreciate those of you who contributed. And we hope that this is helpful.
Yeah. Awesome. So yeah, let's just dive through it through themes that we found in the comments people shared. So first up, basically oversimplified advice, things like just rest, just relax, or don't worry. Oh my gosh, don't worry. That is one that I, that's a hard one for me.
Yeah, exactly. Because it feels really not just simplistic, but it kind of feels like placated, as if it's just, you're just saying it just to say it. And
yeah.
How is that statement supposed to help me in the moment?
Yeah.
Especially like you've mentioned, if they ignore the complexity of trauma, sensory issues, and nervous system dysregulation.
Yeah. It brings to mind two things. One, something we mentioned on the grief episode, which is how the tendency is to pull away from uncomfortable feelings or emotions. So when someone offers a placated response, sometimes they're actually soothing themselves of like, your stress or the fact you aren't well is hard for me. So I'm going to say something that makes me feel better, like just relax, just don't worry. So that's one thought. The second thought I had is it can feel, you know, in its most maybe neutral form, it can be like, well, that's kind of annoying feedback, but it can often trend into invalidation of like invalidating a very real experience around sensory limits or burnout. And those are the things that are kind of like splinters over time that can stack up in ways that make it hard for us to trust ourselves if we're expressing very real needs. And then we get, if we do get a lot of those invalidating responses, especially from like parental figures over time, that can, that's one of the things that can impact that self-trust.
Yeah. And it really does feel like minimization in a lot of ways.
So yeah.
When you are vulnerable or you're struggling and it's met with either feeling dismissed or minimized or just completely missed and overlooked, it can really feel confusing. And I think so often for me, one thing that I always feel like is feeling like the miscommunication or just missing the mark, and feeling that is really a shame response in a lot of ways when I'm trying to communicate something and it just gets completely missed. So it can really be a painful experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And partly because that's part, for many of us, that's often part of our baseline experience is feeling misunderstood. So then those comments, I think for anyone, those comments can be hard, right? Like no matter your neurotype. But I think if your baseline experience is feeling misunderstood, then that's just going to land a bit more sharply when we do get those placated responses. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
So this came from a parent in the Nook who is like really interested in kind of linguistics and like language justice. And I've learned a lot from her, but on one of the parent calls, something she shared, so she shared some of the scripts she uses. And one was, that makes so much sense. Like that makes so much sense. You feel that way. And I love that. And I've started using that more with my kids and with even with myself of like, that makes sense. You feel that way. And it's so simple in phrase, but it's so like, I just kind of melt into the experience of like, oh yeah, it does make sense. I feel that way. Like it's so really comforting.
It's really affirming. And it's like, I see you, you know, like that makes total sense. And I think that's sometimes all we want is just to feel understood or heard or affirmed. And that's a really nice statement.
Yeah. I love that as an alternative to some of that. When maybe, especially if for parents out there, like our kids' anxiety can activate our anxiety and it can be tempting to want to like squash it with like, you know, just do this or just, but like to be able to step into that differently and say, it makes sense you feel that way.
Yeah. That's a great statement to start to incorporate and implement. You have a couple of statements written down here that are kind of some helpful reframes for this one.
Yeah. So I think the one I'll talk about is the like 5%, or sometimes I even make it 2%. So instead of just relax, kind of can we notice like where we feel tension? If it feels comfortable to do like body work, where in your body do you feel tension? And then one question that I'll often ask myself is how do I make this moment 2% better or 5% better? If I was because that feels enough of like, oh, I can do that. I can go get like a weighted blanket. I can go get my sensei and put it on while I'm doing email. I could get on the walking treadmill. I could go in the sunshine. that'll make it 5% better. But if I'm like, how do I get out of my anxiety or how do I relax? That's too big. So I really like the, how do I make this moment 5% or 2% better or more relaxed?
Yeah.
I like that too. Yeah. Yeah.
I also like the one that you have that says replace think positive with plan for what might go wrong so you can actually feel safer when it goes right. For people like me who often think worst case scenario in almost every situation, that would be a very helpful reframe opposed to just like, oh, don't worry about that thing, or like, that's not that big of a deal, or like, why do you feel so overwhelmed by that? Like, being able to plan for the worst case scenario so that if it does go better than expected, then that's a really nice reframe for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also like it because it gives like a lot of autistic and ADHD folks to some degree. I think we spend a lot of time planning out potential scenarios, and that can look a lot like anxiety, and it can be combined with anxiety. But I think what people maybe don't always realize is we do that so that when we're in the moment, we can be less anxious. And part of that has to do with, you know, there's perhaps some controversy over how this will sound, but there's some research that suggests we're not as good at predicting what's going to happen next in the moment. Like our prediction maps are not as like instantaneous. And so, or the ability to predict what's going to happen. So we rely more on prediction maps that we make. So if I'm going into a scenario, I'm going to probably plan out, well, here's 5 different ways this might go. I'm going to create prediction maps for myself. It's like an accommodation I'm making, but it will look like I'm anxiously ruminating. Like, oh, well, maybe I'm going to hop on and Patrick's going to do this. Maybe he's going to do that. Right. But it's like, no, I'm creating prediction maps.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's helpful for sure. Mm-hmm. Some other stuff that we got, which is, this is one I struggle with so much, and I make fun of it publicly often, but meditation, yoga, and mindfulness practices that backfire, like meditation, watch your thoughts, visual meditation, yoga, I see the often frustrating piece or overwhelming. That for me is very real. I've tried to go into like yoga classes before, beginner's yoga, but I can't follow what the instructor is doing. And then I get really frustrated. And then my body is already in a lot of pain. And I'm just like, you know, giving up on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And these can be kind of the classic go-to wellness. And so I think again, this is an area that could fuel a lot of shame for us of like, well, I tried that. It didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And then that collapse into helplessness as well. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Yoga. I've only done it through YouTube. I would never go to a class that being perceived. I'm very inflexible actually. So like,
me too.
Yeah.
I feel like a 2x4, like, I can't bend and touch my toes. Like I can't.
Me neither.
Yeah. It's painful and I'm very like rigid in those movements. So it's really tough for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So the only time I've ever tried it was YouTube. Adrian, Yoga with Adrian or someone. There's someone who's huge on YouTube. I did like, this was years ago, Pop Pilates before, or Blogilates, before she became really, really big. She was combining Pilates with hip hop music. And I actually have never thought about this. So I got really into it kind of in my pregnancy postpartum years, and it totally, because she was using hip-hop music and pop music, it like was stimulating enough. Otherwise Pilates and yoga, it's not stimulating enough to capture my attention.
No, that makes total sense. Another thing that we had written down, gratitude journals, hard to maintain, feels like a chore, and triggers demand avoidance.
Which then isn't going to work at all. Like we know from this research on gratitude journals. So the gratitude research is really interesting. The very first study they ever did, no one knew what to expect. So there was no sense of I am doing this for this outcome. And then after that study, they have replicated it, but it can at times be hard to replicate. Because if you're doing gratitude as a demand, if you're doing it as, I'm doing this because I hear it's going to help my sleep, I hear it's going to help my mood, that right. actually changes the experience of it. So gratitude is tricky. I actually love gratitude research and positive psychology. I find it really fascinating. And there's ways I've adapted it to work for my brain. But so much of it, yeah, if some therapist is like, do a gratitude journal, and we're coming at it as like, this is a to-do, this is a task, this is a demand, yeah, it's probably going to backfire for sure.
Yeah, there might be an odds there for me if that was my therapist, where I wouldn't go back. I would just be like, yeah, so I just can't take this type of advice, and I probably won't come back. So that's,
yeah,
it's definitely led to that in the past.
Well, because it can feel invalidating, right? If it's and minimizing, if it's, I'm really depressed, I'm da-da-da-da, well, have you tried gratitude really?
Exactly. That's exactly how it would feel for me. And I would just look at them probably like, okay. Mm-hmm. And then how much time is left in this session, and how do I get the hell out of here?
Yeah. So can I now give my alternative to gratitude?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. So this is, so I actually have a workbook on gratitude. I haven't marketed it much because I'm like, for all the reasons of like, this can feel really invalidating to be like, sure, you're depressed, try gratitude. So when I like understood the science behind it, that's when I was like, okay, I can get on board with this. And part of this goes back to like the mood congruence effect. So when we're depressed, or well, whatever state we're in, we will, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but we will be more likely to pull out memories that match our current mood. We will also forecast that into the future. So if we're depressed, I'm going to be thinking about all of the memories that are going to come to me, or ones around like where I'm not worthy, all of the really negative stuff. Also my forecasting of the future. So if we know that we're working with a cognitive bias, if we're like depressed or anxious, then can I, from a place of agency, be like, you know, I know my mind is doing this, so I'm gonna actually remind myself. It's kind of like the timeline exercise you mentioned on the first episode. Like, I'm gonna actually remind myself that this is not all there is, and so I'm going to create an experience where I'm tapping into a different emotional experience. I'm reminding my mind this is not all there is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's helpful for me too, to just be able to like zoom out a little bit, because otherwise you get so kind of consumed by the moment. It's hard to see the forest for the trees, so to speak. And I like that approach for sure. Let's see. You've got some suggestions. Good.
Oh, okay. I just like, I guess gratitude is like, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a special interest. I would say positive psychology like gets into that. So I'm just going to go on gratitude for a little bit more.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is my favorite gratitude exercise. And there's a lot of different gratitude exercises out there. And I think the journal, the journal doesn't really work for me either, because it would feel like a demand. But as I go to sleep, like thinking through, okay, what are three moments today that felt good? And if good's not accessible, then that felt neutral. Right. But my favorite practice, and I do this with one of my kids, and it's actually really sweet, and it's called the orange moment. And we maybe want to rename it, because I'm going to explain it, and then I think we're going to both be like, this maybe doesn't work for autistic people. But if you think about an orange, like when you peel it, you know, the whole room will smell of orange. It's a very rich sensory experience. And like the juice gets on your hand. That's the part that autistic people probably don't appreciate. So it's a very like immersive experience. So an orange moment is when you're having just like such a delightful moment, and you want to linger there, and you want to take it in, and you want to smell it, you want to taste it, you want to have that experience of opening an orange. So like my kid and I, when we're having a sweet moment, maybe we'll be cuddling, maybe we'll be in the sun, maybe we'll be like watching Grey's, which is a special interest show, and like assigning neurotypes to all the characters. And we'll kind of look at each other and be like, ah, this is an orange moment. And it's an invitation. We'll just kind of sink into it and like taste it, like be in it. And So that's my favorite gratitude practice, is catching orange moments where I'm just like, oh, this is it. And I'm going to sink into it in all of my sensory systems and experience it and feel it.
Yeah.
And just be kind in of it.
Immerse yourself into it and really absorb it.
Yeah. So orange moment.
Let me just add a side note to that. Sounds really lovely. I despise oranges so much. The smell, the taste, the texture.
The juice on your hands.
Yeah, it's one of my least favorite fruits by far. I just want to name that. Anyway, continuing.
So I sometimes call it the mocha moment because I like mochas are the most comforting beverage to me.
I love mochas for sure.
So I will sometimes call it a mocha moment. And like the smell of it. Yeah, I don't think orange moment works great for us.
Yeah, as soon as you started describing like an orange moment and opening an orange, I got like a visceral reaction where I was like, oh God, I hate oranges so much.
Okay, so this would be a great example. That's the kind of, that's out there in positive psychology. I'm not sure who coined it, but maybe that works for other people. So to adapt it for autistic ADHDers, maybe it's a mocha moment. Although some people will have sensitivities to coffee. So maybe it's whatever like item brings just so much sensory delight. It's that, right. It's X moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just really allowing yourself to absorb it and sit in it and immerse yourself into it and at like a cellular level in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I like that for sure. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Okay. So we can move on from gratitude now. Thanks for letting me,
It sounds like we can continue on that for a long time, but so other strategies that you wrote down, try embodied focus, surfing, climbing, walking, hand work instead of seated meditation. Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty good to me because seated meditation for me is really hard. I'm usually really uncomfortable. I'm usually really like, I'm fidgeting around a lot. I'm like sitting on my knees a lot. I'm like trying to move around. Yeah, my lower back pain starts up, but getting into that movement or climbing or walking or anything like that, mm-hmm. that's much more accessible for me.
Well, and for ADHDers, it's stimulating enough because mm-hmm. like if we don't have enough stimulus, you know, our mind will create it through distraction. Yeah. So if we're trying to do a sitting meditation, there's not much stimulus there. Like that's going to be really hard for our mind to slow down. So I've been slowly reclaiming my relationship to meditation. We actually had someone, a new member in the Nook, Fleur Chambers is her name. She's from Australia and she has spent like 15 years in the meditation space and then is kind of newly considering things through a neurodivergent lens. So thinking through how to adapt it. And she did a session in the Nook that was so good, broke down like all of the myths around meditation, all the different kinds of meditation. And one of the things she identified is that so often, this is what comes to mind as seated meditation, but that's just really one kind. And it's right. often the kind that's recommended to folks. And then it's like, well, that doesn't work for me, which I left that session. She led us through a meditation and I felt so like deeply connected to myself, to others, to my, like it was restorative. I was like, oh my gosh, I think I like meditation. What is happening?
I love that. And it's a great perspectives check because I think when you hear seated meditation and your mind instantaneously says, I can't do that, or I don't enjoy that, you shut everything else down in terms mm-hmm. of possibility. So really allowing to know that there is more than one way to do a lot of these things that are often offered to us in terms of wellness activities. And I think that's a really important adaptation.
And maybe that goes to like learning from neurodivergent people, right? Because we do have to adapt. If these things are going to work for us, we often have to adapt them. So finding teachers who are experts in these things and neurodivergent and can like translate it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because it's certainly not a one size fits all approach in any sense of the word. Mm-hmm. The next one you have, I really like using neutral grounding statements instead of emptying the mind. And like, for example, I'm in my room, my feet are on the floor. You've even done this on the podcast before where you've grabbed a cold drink and said like, I'm grabbing this cold drink and I'm acknowledging how cold it is on my hand and the sensation. And that for me would be much more accessible than when I have been told in the past, just allow whatever thoughts are there to come in and, you know, be just really empty your mind. And again,
It's one of those moments where you almost instantaneously get frustrated and and it's like, again, I can't do this.
Yeah. That is those moments. Like I just had a body memory of you describing that. Because those moments have always felt so, I'm going to say the word that I can't say, claustrophobic.
Claustrophobic. Yep. Remember when someone asked us like early on in the podcast and they're like, what word is Meg and Anna trying to say in this episode? And I swear to you, I was convinced it was like a word. And I was like, she's saying claustrophobic. And like, I said it with such confidence too, like,
anyway, I definitely got some emails of like, is this a word that
Can't find it anywhere?
So claw. Like a claw. Closet,
right? So like
claustrophobic. Okay. So it makes me feel claustrophobic to think about it because it's, I can't empty my mind. And then I'm thinking about how I can't empty my mind. And then also going back to something we shared a couple of weeks ago, the idea of how painful it is to be alone with my thoughts. So then I've got a lot of systems to not, and I realize that's emotional avoidance and it's something I'm working on, y'all. But it's that sort of emptying mind can feel very painful, partly because I can't do it. And then I'm thinking about how I can't do it and I'm judging myself, but also just because there are a lot of like hard things that can come up around that.
For sure.
And also the demand avoidance. Like, so I went to a lot of youth retreats growing up where the speaker was definitely trying to get an emotional experience out of you. And I remember always being like, I'm not feeling the thing that everyone else seems to be feeling. What's wrong with me? And so there's also like, whenever someone is leading me through something where they're trying to get an experience out of me, I don't respond great to that.
Same. And I can like remember this in certain clinical trainings that I've done. So I did brain spotting training with a couple of my staff a few years ago, and they put us in like these practicum rooms, and I couldn't access whatever they needed me to access. But you've got an observer and you're trying to like react for your partner. So instead of just sitting there for 15 minutes saying like, I am not accessing anything, I just made shit up because I was like, I feel bad for my partner. But I felt so embarrassed for myself that like, how is everyone else having these experiences? I'm not accessing anything.
No, absolutely. And I love you brought the clinical space up because I think that's really common for neurodivergent people going, or autistic people specifically going through clinical training. There's a lot of role playing. There's a lot of like on-demand experiencing, like on-demand experiencing, on-demand emotions. And maybe that's it with meditation too, guided meditation, is it can feel like you're supposed to have on-demand experience or on-demand emotion, which for those, partly, I think, partly demand of like, partly autonomy stuff around demands, but also I could imagine just because I think many of us do process our emotions a bit more slowly or more privately, that that's really uncomfortable for a lot of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are some of my most uncomfortable moments, actually going through practicum and internship and the clinical side of like my grad school program.
Go ahead. Did you have to do role plays? Role plays were so awkward for me.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I was just so bad at them. And I always felt so bad for my partners because I was like, I don't know how to be in this space. And this was pre-discovery. So I'm sure, I don't know what they left those rooms thinking, but it certainly was not like I want to be partners with Patrick again. It probably was awful.
Yeah, totally. It would make me so anxious, the classes we had to do role plays in. And I my mind couldn't do it. I'd have to either be real like me or channel a client that that I'd had historically. Like I just couldn't, it's that whole imagination. Well, it is interesting. I have a vivid imagination, but the whole like, tell me a story right now, like my brain, in the same way that if my kids are like, tell me a story, like I really struggle with that. It's the same thing with role play of like, I don't know how to do that unless it's real.
Right. Yeah. It was very tough for me. And I actually gave, this is a good reminder. I actually gave my professor feedback in that class that I could not do it because it felt disingenuous.
Yes.
Like, we've been watching your tapes and listening, and we can tell you're struggling in this. And I said, I can't do this because mm-hmm. this isn't real. And they were like, what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is an assessment that is done around autism. And one of the activities is kind of looking at scenes, and then mm-hmm. you're supposed to say what you'd feel like if you were the person, and you're supposed to react like them. Like so you might see a scene or a picture or a photo of like two people chatting. And one person's maybe looking disgusted. So it's like, okay, what are you thinking? And for so many of us, and this was my natural inclination, is to be like, well, I would be thinking, like, we start describing it versus like, mm-hmm. oh, that's so disgusting. Like, that's what you're supposed to do, is like be in it. And that is, and this is what will sometimes get called theory of mind. Like, oh, well, you don't have theory of mind, so you're struggling to do that. And like, maybe there's something in perspective taking. I mean, theory of mind theory has been, you know, that's kind of, yeah, not, that's problematic for many reasons, but maybe there is something to perspective taking. But for me, what's most accessible is just that feels so disingenuous and awkward to speak from the first person of someone that I'm not. So I can say like, well, if I was in that situation, I'd be thinking.
Right. And then the person assessing you is like checking that box very clearly. Very, very much a struggle for sure. Skipping through some of these, I'm going to go into sensory wellness that misses the mark.
Is there any other adaptations around meditation or mindfulness?
Sure. Go ahead.
Sorry, I keep slowing
us
down.
I'm just reading through your doc, so I'm just going through.
So for mindfulness, I do love mindfulness. But mindfulness is not an activity. It is a way of being. It is a way of being with ourselves. And so I do a lot of like mindfulness on the go. And so like tagging of scripts of like, oh, that story's going right there. And it's just it's non-judgmental observing, like naming that. Or it's kind of clunky, but I'm noticing I'm having the thought. So like let's see, what would be an example? Like if I have the thought like I'm a terrible mom, right? Then I might, to create a little bit of distance from that, I might be like, okay, I'm noticing I'm having the thought I'm a terrible mom. And then what it's doing is, instead of being totally hooked and fused on that thought, it's, yep, that's what my mind is doing right now. It's like giving me a thought that's painful, and I'm going to notice it. And so that sort of mindfulness on the go has been so helpful for my mental health. So helpful. Yeah. Sitting down and doing a 10-minute mindfulness. I'm not going to be the person that does that, but I do a ton of mindfulness on the go.
Yeah, I like that. And you've mentioned that before, and that's definitely more my speed for sure. Sensory wellness that misses the mark. This is probably a big one for those of you listening. Like, and here are some examples. Candlelight and bubble baths. And the quote is, I don't know if this is your quote or someone else's.
This was from a Substack person, is I find it boring and uncomfortable.
Yep, can relate. Mm-hmm. Drawing a bath that takes longer than the time spent in it. I get bored and damp. Okay, yes. That sounds right. Oh my God, this is one of my worst ones. Massages.
Yes.
Requiring
yes.
much unpredictability, social interaction, and these quote unquote soothing activities that often misfire for sensory sensitive or touch averse folks. Massages for me are hell. Mm-hmm. I am definitely touch averse, and it just makes me so unbelievably uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I think about when getting a massage is about the person who's giving the massage, how much time they have left until they get to be done with the experience. And that's like in my mind the whole time. Like,
oh my goodness,
they have like 5 minutes left or 10 minutes left until they can be done with this.
Yeah. Yeah. People recommend massages to me all the time. And I'm like, excuse me.
Pass.
Yeah. So I had an interesting experience But I still don't go to massages even after this. So a few years ago, I was very lucky that it wasn't worse, but I was in a highway accident where like a car spun into my lane and then I was able to get out, but I hit a tree and I was okay, but I had a lot of neck and back pain from it. So I mm-hmm. was going to the chiropractor regularly and he was like, if you do a massage before our work, that's really going to be helpful. And it just, because it was medical, it just like forced it. So for 6 weeks, I would go every week and I would do a massage and then a chiropractor. Mm-hmm. And it really was helpful for the pain. And I think maybe because it was like, this is medical, I got into a rhythm of it where I was like, okay, this is actually like, I can see the benefit of it. But right. even knowing that and having been someone that has a bit of neck and back pain, I still don't like actively like, I'm going to go get a massage because it's, unless it's very medically necessary, I'm going to avoid it. But I do see the physical benefits of it after I've done it, which is annoying.
I go to the chiropractor pretty regularly for my like lower back pain. And I think it's fine. It has some usefulness, but there's this one process because it's always the same positioning, like lay on your back first and then lay on your left side. And then she'll be like, now lay on your back so I can crack your neck. But it's a really like intimate experience where I'm like my back, holding my head up, like looking into my face, cracking my neck. So I have to like associate majorly where I'm like,
oh yeah,
I can't look at you right now. And this is so uncomfortable for me.
So this would be another example of like it's hard to do, but when we can find neurodivergent aware providers. So I have a chiropractor I adore, and I actually need to go back because my hip pelvic stuff is flaring again. But she like, first of all, legit like cured me of my 10-year chronic pain. I had like hip pelvic pain that the doctors were like, let's do hip MRIs. And like, and then I go to a chiropractor and it was just amazing. But I told her I was autistic ADHD and she was aware. And so she does a drop table and she was so good. She like, before we did the first drop, she's like, I'm just going to let you know what it sounds like. So you know what to expect. But for the next stuff, it's face down and she does it through the drop table instead of what you're describing.
Right.
And so again, that's where if we've got providers who can adapt some of these things, it makes it so much more accessible to us.
Yeah. Huge difference for sure. Mm-hmm. Huge difference.
Yeah. Any other like sensory? So you don't like baths?
No. I don't know if we want my real thoughts on them. I just think they're disgusting. Like I think.
Like from an OCD lens.
Yeah, the idea of like going into a bath and just sitting there,
sitting there in a mix of like your film.
Yeah, it just feels disgusting.
Do you feel that way about hot tubs?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I don't like hot tubs either. So those are out for me. They'd be like, take an Epsom salt bath. And I can kind of get behind that mentality when you're in like significant pain and I'm like, oh, is this going to help me play more or like, you know, not and be able to walk down the stairs? If so, okay, I can get behind that, but I don't want to just sit in a bath for like pleasure purposes or relaxation.
I will occasionally, like if I'm really in a state where like my body just needs to be immersed in warmth and a shower won't cut it, that's when I'll do a bath. But it's rare because it feels like a lot of prep and transition, like the transition in and out. But I have to have a really good audiobook or podcast. Otherwise, it's too boring. But I do like the immersion in warm water is one of the most soothing experiences for me. But the transitions around it are hard. So I'd actually probably benefit from doing it pretty regularly, except the transitions is what makes it so I don't do it very often.
My height makes like uncomfortable because I'll be like sitting in a bathtub at 6'2" and then like your legs are just kind of like sprawled over. You're like tucked into your chest. Like it's not.
That doesn't sound enjoyable.
It's for me.
This is like a rare situation where my height would be an advantage. Like being 5'2", a bath is a very different experience than being 6'2".
Yeah. You know, I will say being tall is not
anything that it's cracked up to be. I can reach things for people. It's so painful, especially with all the like chronic pain, stiffness, rigidity. Like it's so painful.
I think you should start a new account about like the, what would be the word for ableist, but for tall, like the tallest and like the struggles of tall people.
Yes.
The oppression of tall people.
Right. Oh God. Yeah.
Okay. I'm joking there, but I actually agree with you. And I learned this through clients that I worked with. I worked with some clients who were very introverted and very tall. And it was so interesting. And, you know, we were working kind of psychodynamically around just what their experience of being a human was. And at some point I realized this person doesn't have the option of blending in. I can walk into a room as a 5'2 person and I can blend in. Yeah. But what would it be like when you walk in and everyone's like, oh, you're tall. And like, you are the tallest person and you stand out and you don't have the option to blend in, and then psychologically about how you would carry yourself when that's your experience. I actually think height is really interesting psychologically.
Yeah. I'm very aware of like being taller than most people I'm around and how you get like looks when you walk past certain people. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. But I also was told by
coworkers, people comment on it because they don't see it as a bad thing. So they can be like, right, oh, you're like, so tall.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, yes, that is true. I had a coworker tell me back in the day that I didn't swing my arms when I walked and that I walked like a serial killer is what she used to say. So now I'm very aware that I like swing my arms when I walk, but now I am in my head all the time of like, am I swinging my arms because I'm supposed to be swinging my arms, or is this actually how I walk now? And I don't know the difference. I don't know.
Well, and this reminds me of, I heard you say this, I think it was at your TEDx talk, how you used to never smile. Mm-hmm. But Ariel taught you how to smile with your teeth.
Yeah.
But like, I've always thought, I hope this, tell me how this lands. When I see your photo, it doesn't feel like you. And I'm like, it feels like the smile that you do, the classic, like Patrick, like hand on hip smile. It's like, where's Patrick? Like, I don't see you in it. And it makes me think of the hand swinging and like, how many things do you do? Cause it's like, you've been taught.
Yeah.
Well, like, me taking a picture and not smiling, I look like a serial killer. And me walking without moving my hands, I look like a serial killer. So,
there are like three people who joined in on that conversation too. They're like, you don't swing your hands when you walk. They're like, maybe you are a serial killer. And I was like, what is happening right now? And now I swing my arms when I walk. So there's that. And that, you know, just masking to fit in. And then your body is just like, this is what we do now. And
Don't be a serial killer. That's like, we just learned.
Wellness piss. Yeah, that is a part of this. So anyway, sensory wellness that misses the mark and adaptations. So you say trade bubble baths for pressure blankets, warm socks, or wrapping in a hoodie burrito.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, again, that's not going to work for everyone. Everyone has different sensory systems, but pressure, warmth. I know those are things that feel good for me and can give a similar sensation, but with less transitions.
Yeah. Swap candles for your preferred scent stim, essential oil roller, favorite lotion, even clean laundry. Yeah. Smells for me, my olfactory sense is off the charts. And like, I really have to, wait, is olfactory smell?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I was like thinking I said that incorrectly.
Got it.
I really need like neutral, soothing smells. And it's amazing the difference in terms of sensory experience for me based on that. So
smells are huge for me.
Yeah.
Like Luke and I were on a walk last night and we walked by a house that obviously was doing laundry. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I bet you like that smell. He's like, yeah, I love it. I was like, yeah, if it was like, I was like, I can tell that's a good, like that's a nice smell. But it's so overwhelming to my system and gives me a headache that if maybe it was like 1/100th of that, then I could enjoy it. But just the intensity alone. So here's a question. For me, it's like a chemical thing. Like I just can't do artificial smells, but I actually really do like essential oils because they are a strong, intense sensory experience and they don't give me headaches because they're natural.
Right.
For you, is it all intense smell stuff, or is it like a for me, it's very much like chemical or natural is the big thing.
No, it's just like intensity. Yeah, it's everything. And it's really bothersome because it can really disrupt your day big time. And like even disrupt my sleep. Like if our dog needs a bath and he's like, just smells like outside, like too much, right? Mm-hmm. Or like sweat or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I will smell
it. Yeah, that's hard. Room,
and I'm like, oh my God. He just like snorted while he's laying on the floor next to me like a pig. But yeah, so I'll smell that really intensely or like food that's been cooking or like anything. And yeah, it's just so hard for me. Smells are really, really, really challenging.
Yeah. And this can have a big social impact because like there's people in my life I can be text friends with,
yeah,
but not embodied because maybe they enjoy wearing perfume or cologne. And like, it's too much of a deterrent to want to be with them.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, certain restaurants in town, if my friends ask me to go, I'm like, I really have to be in like peak sensory stabilization regulation mode to be able to say yes to certain things if I know how impactful they're going to be. Like if I was at like a phone charge battery or a video game life battery, I would really need to be at 100% in order to say yes to certain things.
Are there any smells that you like that delight you, that you really like, that you could be like, I want more of this in my life?
Yeah, I really like mint smelling things. Mm-hmm. I really like eucalyptus, spearmint, any sort of mint refreshing type of smell. I really despise like citrusy, florally, anything that's perfumey, anything. Yeah, it's tough. But yeah, mint, eucalyptus, anything that would feel like typically refreshing in that way. Mm-hmm. Or like cooling is what I would say.
Yeah, no, I like that stuff too. Yeah. Do you use scented deodorant or unscented?
Unscented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Scent is so, because so much of like body care is scented and that's then so intimate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's probably hence like 3 showers a day type of thing too. 2 to 3 mm-hmm. showers a day. There are certain coffee shops in town that my friends really like and I think they smell awful. And I really like these coffee shops, but I have to go knowing that I will immediately take a shower after and wash my clothes immediately. Mm-hmm. Because the smell is so overpowering for me that it's like hard to be in.
Yeah. I worked at a coffee shop for several years and I would just come home and just like, I would just be smelling of coffee. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was like clothes in the wash, shower. Yeah. It was so, and I actually really like the smell of coffee, but when you work at a coffee shop, it's too much.
One of my first jobs was at a Subway and Subway smells so bad. And it's the bread that is constantly like being baked in the ovens there. And it gets in like your clothes, your hair, your skin, and it's really hard to get off. And it was really hard to be in all the time.
Mm-hmm. So now I'm thinking about, because sensory wellness, I'm thinking about for folks for whom, you and I both like showers as a sensory experience, for whom have these experiences, maybe they work somewhere where there's a lot of sensory stuff, and then they come home and showers are actually a undesired sensory experience. Like that's pretty brutal if it's, I'm absorbing sensory smells throughout the day. I really want it off my body. And to do that, I have to do an unpleasant activity.
Right.
That's brutal.
Have any strategies for those people?
I mean, like why? Like I know, like so adjustments for that would be like wipes, like using hand wipes and like dry shampoo. Like there's a lot of workarounds. You don't have to shower every day, or you don't have to shower to get that off. So probably changing clothes. But there's still like some sensory transition around using the wipes, but probably better than shower. I think someone mentioned this. They learned it from TikTok, but I think it's brilliant. If it's a temperature change thing, especially in like colder climates, setting up a little space heater before you hop into the shower so that when you're coming out, you're not getting that. Cause you know that like hot to cold, like that's a terrible sensory experience. So if you have a little space heater in your bathroom so that the air temperature is a little bit warmer, when you're coming out of the shower. That's when I heard that sounds brilliant to me. I haven't tried it yet, but that sounds like that would be helpful.
Yeah. Thinking of sensory stuff, temperature for me is also another one. That's a really hard, like my temperature regulation / like interoceptive senses. I know when it's above 67 degrees at all times. Like I am so uncomfortable once it hits 68, 69, 70 and above. And like, I can sense it and like go look at my thermostat and I'll be like, yep, it's that one degree difference too, where it's like, how did it just go from just right to like unbelievably uncomfortable in that slight variation? So hard.
Mm-hmm. So that would probably be an adaptation for sensory wellness is as much as is possible, controlling the temperature environment.
Yeah.
And obviously that's going to, for some, and that's what's really hard, especially with climate collapse, right? We're seeing more fluctuations and not everyone has access to air conditioning or consistent heating in the sense where you do have that tight control over your environment. Or there might be people in the house. Like, so for me, I run really cold. And then I've got a kid with POTS and who runs really hot. So it's also like there's going to be different temperature needs in the same household sometimes as well.
Yeah, totally. I've had to default to like those little like portable pocket fans at times or like cold packs and things like that. And
yeah,
in terms of like accommodation. That's why I also will no longer stay at my dad's house in Florida because he keeps the thermostat at 77 degrees, which is outrageous, but like
that's too hot for me. And that's saying something. Yeah. I start feeling kind of like almost like feverish when it's at 70 and it's I don't feel good in my body. Yeah.
No, it's not fun for me. So.
Okay. Other like things on here is replacing massages for things like, again, weighted pressure, self-massage tools, because then we have more autonomy over it.
Right.
Or this is where I feel like I talk about all the time, but I love TENS units, which is that like electrical pulse experience. I love that sensation so much. And I use that a lot for my lower back stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are really helpful. Having that chronic lower back pain, it's super helpful. And you can just pop it on for 15, 20 minutes and it can really, really help quite a bit.
Yeah. 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 Well, so we've gone through some of the anti-wellness tips and adaptations. Do we want to wrap here and continue this conversation next week?
Yeah, I think this is a good place for sure.
Okay. Do you want to do the like mindless ending where you tell people to go like our stuff, or should we go for a more awkward, authentic invitation into interdependence?
Wow, what a choice.
When I put it that way.
Yeah, very leading. It that way, where's your mind going right now?
I want us to have a script, but I want it to be a script that we do at the end that's feels more connected to what we're actually saying and asking of people, but where it's not me awkwardly going off on a rabbit trail like this every time.
Yeah. So if you do like Divergent Conversations, new episodes are out on Fridays on all major platforms and YouTube. We have our transcripts up on our website, divergentpod.com. You'll always have access to those. Our YouTube channel has all of our full-length recordings, video recordings. We also just started a Substack.
So if you want to continue the conversation, that's where you can go.
If you want to continue the conversation, come on to our Substack. What else?
And then if you're looking for other ways just to support our work, and if any of the sponsorships that we put in front of you sound like they would be supportive and aligned, that is something that helps us to secure sponsorships, which helps us keep doing the work.
Yeah. And if that is right now, sponsor is Jane App, which is for mental health professionals in private practice. And you can use code DCPOD for 2 free months. And they actually have a really good platform for autism assessments, and their data privacy policies are really secure in comparison to some other platforms. So I think there's a lot of reasons to like them right now. And code goes into a very weird place where you probably would overlook it, where it says like corporate
codes, educational codes, and something else.
And something code. Yeah.
Something code. But make sure you don't overlook that if you are going to use the platform. And we have links to all of that stuff in our show notes as well. And we will see you next week for our finale.
Goodbye.